Across the Tracks, a Route 66 story on Public Radio International.
At 66 Highway, the Will Rogers Road, it's lined with jalopies as far as you can see. Mighty hot motor and a heavy old load from old Oklahoma to Los Angeles.
Route 66 is America's main street from Chicago to Los Angeles, the old road. Few of us can imagine a time when she wasn't there. She laid down many of our cities and towns right where they are today. Route 66 determined a future we fondly recall as the past. A magical time of adventures and neon-lit diners, famed in story and song. To John Steinbeck, Route 66 was America's mother road. Here are the stories people made up and left behind on America's most famous road. This is Across the Tracks, and I'm Martin Milner. I explored the old road in a fast Corvette on the Route 66 TV series.
We would travel Route 66 to go back home and visit grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, and all that type of thing.
Bob Moore is the editor of Route 66 magazine.
It was white knuckle for my mom, because at that time, most of 66 was two-lane. And my dad was a big car man, Packards and Cadillacs and Lincolns, and lots of power, and trucks were a nuisance, so we got to pass every truck on the road. You know, there were permanent indentations in the armrest where my mom was just squeezing it.
A friend of mine and I drove to Los Angeles on Route 66 in the early 60s.
David Knudsen, president of the National Route 66 Federation.
To me, I'd never been further west than St. Louis. It was the west as you drove along, the many, many Indian businesses selling blankets and pottery, and then around that corner is the Rattlesnake Farm, and around the next corner was the so-and-so caves, and then the following one, stop here and see the three-headed cow, and it was constant, and it was this 2,400-mile carnival.
Who among us has never traveled, or thought of traveling, Route 66? It's a road for all classes. It hosted the Model T Ford, jalopies, and broken-down trucks during the Depression. In the 50s and 60s, there were Packards and sleek convertibles. 66 is more than a road. It's a living history.
Get your kicks on what's left. 66.
Route 66 is the perfect example of the open road and all the romance and adventure and mystique that come with that.
Tom Teague is a founder of the Route 66 Association in Springfield, Illinois.
Most of all, it's the idea of a road 2,400 miles long that you can get on at any time, at any place, and travel as far as you want to, as fast as you can get away with, and never have to pass through a national checkpoint.
If you ever plan to motor west, travel my way, take the highway, that's the best. Get your kicks on Route 66. It winds from Chicago to LA, more than 2,000 miles all the way. Get your kicks on Route 66.
Route 66, like the railroads, transformed this country, making it what it is today. And yet there are times she seems to exist only as an historic marker, a T-shirt, a coffee mug, a broken-down sign, an abandoned gas station in the old part of town. In 1984, Route 66 was finally bypassed by the interstates. The old road isn't as well kept as she used to be. Huge stretches are missing, allowed to fall into disrepair or peter out into a field. And America's so used to nostalgic travel on 66 that we forget its darker sides. Michael Wallace is the well-known author of Route 66, The Mother Road.
This highway really is like a mirror held up to the nation, and I do think it reflects who we are, where we've been, and in a way where we're going. And sometimes the reflection is good, sometimes it's a bit cloudy, sometimes it's ugly. It's a bittersweet journey. Let's face it, not every traveler has felt welcome on the highway.
Part of what's reflected is a country and a road whose history is mired in prejudice. America's images of Route 66 are predominantly white from its books and TV series. Many have forgotten the Native Americans and Hispanics who first lived along its path, the Japanese Americans interned there, or the African Americans who lived and traveled on America's main street. For Ernie Edwards, owner of the now-closed Pig Hip restaurant in Illinois, racism was part of business.
The Mexicans were pretty rough sometimes. They'd come in, and if you seen them coming, you'd lock the doors, really. And if they stole two tires and a quart of oil or so that you had out in front, you said, well, I was lucky this time. But if they got in, they could steal you blind, and gypsies were the same. And then, of course, we had the colored. We couldn't feed them inside. It wasn't law. That was just people.
Edmund Threed, a black farmer whose family gave land to build 66, remembers how this racism worked in rural Oklahoma.
You couldn't go down there to get a pop if you was out there on the road. They would bring it to the door, and don't you open it. Right on Route 66 in the early 80s.
Michael Wallace.
There were discouraging times. There were bad times.
Michael Amundson, historian at Northern Arizona University.
We have to be very careful that it's not the Disneyfication of history. When you create this wholesome white Route 66, you give up a lot of its history. 66 didn't cause segregation, but the places that Route 66 went through were very segregated. And I think it's important that we don't just white bread Route 66.
Before there was a road, there was a way, a stagecoach trail, a Pony Express rider's rut. Before that, a path barely a foot wide, allowing tribes to trade with one another.
I always considered the railroad and the old road as allies.
Michael Wallace.
They both follow the same path. That's very, very important to know that it's such an old path in reality before it was even Route 66.
In the 1880s, the overland way to California from the Midwest was a set of perils. Wolf packs hunting at night, quicksand and marsh, wind and dust storms, and long treks across mountains and burning deserts. Long before anyone thought of highways across America, traveling from Chicago to Los Angeles often meant boarding a schooner in New York to Nicaragua, crossing the isthmus by mule and wagon, then sailing up past Mexico to California, a month-long voyage at best. In the beginning were native settlers. Where they encountered the railroad, this is where the story of Route 66 begins and where a new culture and country was born. Ishi by Theodora Kroeber is the story of a man and his tribe, an account of the last member of the Yahi living in California at the beginning of the 20th century. His only connection to the world of white men was the long metal snake which twisted through the brown valley below. Its horn pierced the silence, reflecting bright against the lion-colored dust of California's Central Valley. To Ishi, the railroad was his only contact with society.
The train represents the symbol of civilization and progress.
Dave Edmonds is a Cherokee historian at the University of Texas, Dallas.
It obviously was phenomenally formidable to him. Probably one of the biggest man-made things he had ever seen. What's more, it unlike like houses or structures, it is something that moves and makes sounds with belching and steam and smoke and bells ringing. And from Ishii's perspective, this is the spearhead of change, but it is a spearhead being thrust by Anglo-Americans.
In the 1880s, railways were snaking their way east from California and west from Illinois along what would be Route 66. A dozen railroads cut a path for Route 66. The Illinois Central, the Frisco, the Rock Island, and the Santa Fe. Keeping track was enough to give you the timetable blues.
They run all day, trying to keep up with the Santa Fe, Santa Fe. Sure do go, trying to make connection with the B&O, B&O. Runs to the sea, trying to keep up with the old IC, IC.
The connection between the railroad and Route 66 is essential in understanding either one of them.
Michael Amundson, historian.
Especially for understanding Route 66, because the migration across the Southwest to California is embedded first by wagon roads following old Indian trails, and then the railroads pick up on these, and roads following the railroads and the telegraph, the whole communication and transportation, this whole infrastructure of the Southwest is organized in an east-west fashion.
Following the steel ribbon of railroad track came the automobile. At the end of the 19th century, these mechanical contraptions were such a rarity that gasoline had to be bought at central depots, few and far between. When you ran out of gas, you just ran out of gas. Most roads out west were widened dirt paths, hardened by the stamp of horse hooves and buggy wheels. But after 1913, when Henry Ford introduced assembly line manufacturing, there came an automobile, the Model A, that was not just for rich, eccentric folks.
Now you folks listen to what I say about a new Ford called a Model A. Hold on, Henry, do his business. He says, I'm gonna make a lady out of this. Fella bought one just the other day. He went to try it out on the new highway. When he got 260, well, he lost his nerve. He forgot to shut it off when he went around the curve.
They were no longer just the play toy of the wealthy and affluent. Now, a school teacher could have an automobile. A clerk, a farmer could drive a car. With the swell of interest in cars, with that tide building, the so-called good roads movement, we simply needed these highways.
Country towns were released from isolation and different communities connected with surprising results.
Route 66 ends up being the highway that links all these local worlds inextricably together, local worlds that had not really been linked so tightly before. But now you have the circulation of people, of goods, of culture, of music, of ideas.
David Montejano is the past director of the Center for Mexican American Studies at the University of Texas.
Can you imagine the diversity that Route 66 links up? When you think of Chicago and St. Louis, the urban residents of those areas, commingling with the farm families from Illinois and Missouri, and then the Latino Hispanic communities of New Mexico and Arizona with the Native American communities of those areas as well, finally ending up in Los Angeles. Unfortunately, until relatively recently, we've only had a very static portrayal of that diversity.
This next tune, The Arkansas Traveler, describes an encounter between an Ozarker and a lost city slicker.
Good day, my good man.
It ain't and I'm not.
Well, does this road fork around here?
Splits all to pieces on that next turn there.
Well, how about that creek over there? Is it fordable?
My neighbor's ducks forded it this morning.
I mean, how deep is it?
Came up to about here on the ducks.
Say, your wife's dress is mighty short.
It'll be long enough before she gets another one.
Well, how far is it from here to Skeeksville?
Well, it's about 3 lengths of a fool, and if you don't believe me, just lay down and measure it yourself.
You're not very smart, are you?
I ain't lost.
Many people never imagined the car would take the place of the horse and buggy or the iron horse, but by the 20s, it did. And afternoon rides began to take the place of the porch swing on Sunday afternoons. The automobile released teenagers from the watchful eyes of their elders with such enticing freedom. It was no wonder the popularity of the automobile soared.
Every woman I know is crazy about an automobile. Shoot, shoot, doo-doo. Every woman I know crazy about an automobile. Shoot, shoot, doo-doo. And here I am standing with nothing but a rubber wheel.
In 1921, the Federal Highway Act was passed. Oklahoman Cyrus Avery helped to design a national highway system. Towns and road clubs hungered to be included. The highway brought commerce to the town it passed. But nothing was simple. Avery and his colleagues found the name Route 60 was taken. They had to settle for Route 66. On November 11th, 1926, the Main Street of America was officially born.
And when it happened, the road was an immediate success.
The road emerged from Lake Michigan in Chicago and ran across the old wire road in Missouri. It dove gently down across Kansas and swooped through Oklahoma and the Texas Panhandle. 66 drove across rugged mountains and deserts of New Mexico, Arizona, and California all the way to Santa Monica. It braked at the Pacific Ocean. The new road was alive and breathing the fumes of autos and trucks. In 1926, only about 800 miles were paved. The remaining 1,648 miles were either dirt, gravel, brick, or asphalt, even wood planks. U.S. 66 boosters dreamed up the most unusual stunt, a transcontinental foot race along Route 66 from Los Angeles to Chicago and then New York. Reporters called it the Bunyan Derby. It was won in 1928 by a part Cherokee farm boy who made the run in 573 hours. Andy Payne from Oklahoma.
Dear Okie, if you see Arky, tell him Tex got a job for him out in California, picking up prunes, squeezing all out of olives.
A year later, the Great Depression hit. Oklahoma and other states across the Great Plains generated a flood of refugees and turned the Mother Road into what John Steinbeck coined the Road of Flight.
Now he'll be lucky if he finds a place to live, but there's orange juice fountains flowing for those kids of his. Dear Okie, if you see Arky, tell him Tex got a job for him out in California, digging all the wells. All he needs is a shovel.
Steinbeck captured the flight of the dispossessed in his epic novel, later a film by John Ford, The Grapes of Wrath.
66 is the path of a people in flight. Refugees from dust and shrinking land, from the thunder of tractors and shrinking ownership, from the desert's slow and northward invasion, from the twisting winds that howl up out of Texas, from the floods that bring no richness to the land and steal what richness is there. From all of these, people are in flight, and they come into 66 from the tributary side roads, from the wagon tracks and the rutted country roads. 66 is the mother road, the road of flight.
Thank you. Here, Henry Fonda plays the part of Tom Joad.
What happened?
Everybody's leaving, going out to California.
Who done it?
Listen, that's someone who done it. The Dusters, they started anyways. Blowing like this year after year, blowing the land away, blowing the crops away, blowing us away now.
Fellow Okie Woody Guthrie saw the film and stayed up all night writing the ballad, Tom Joad.
Tom Joad, he met a truck driving man. There he called him a ride. He
said, Bess Lomax Hawes was Guthrie's housemate when he wrote the ballad.
He worked on that, and then he would come downstairs at night and put the typewriter on the dining room table and sit there and drink coffee and write all night long. You'd come down in the morning and he would be asleep over the typewriter and the floor covered with sheets of typewriter paper.
They stood on a mountain and they looked to the west and it looked like the promised land. That bright green valley with a river running through, there was work for every single hand, they thought. There was work for every single hand.
Rye Cooter.
This Dust Bowl thing started up, and everybody started heading west, and everybody went west. You know, that country down there was emptied out. All these farmers just had to go. And what a strange experience, you know. I love the one about on the 14th day of April in 1935, there struck the worst of dust storm. You could see the dust storm coming, the clouds looked death-like black, and through the mighty nation left a dreadful track. It just must have been unbelievable.
On the 14th day of April of 1935, there struck the worst of dust storms that ever filled the sky. You could see that dust storm coming, the cloud looked death-like black, and through our mighty nation it left a dreadful track. From Oklahoma City to the Arizona line.
Julie Cunico.
Bob Lee remembers when there was three of us children. When we went to bed at night, Mother would hang wet dish towels from the open windows. She would put a wet dish towel over each of our faces. The next morning, the whole thing would be red. Just red. Red dirt. This went on day after day, and we got used to not even seeing the sun.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a rambling round. I work when I can get it, I roam from town to town. Police make it hard, boys, wherever I may go. I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
Though the Joads were its most famous travelers, Route 66 had many who were less well-known and even less well-off. African Americans had originally come to Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas after the Civil War. Now they were on the move again, west.
It was the way west. Route 66 almost went from coast to coast.
Angel Delgadillo.
Route 66, history tells us, is one of the first paved highways. It was just the highway that took them from east to west or west to east. Going up to Williams, to our doctors and to the store, once you got behind a long string of cars, you just stayed there. You just crawled. And then once in a while, you'd see a brave one. Boy, shoo, boy, he just went around and he just barely got away with the skin of his teeth.
Travelers and migrants were sometimes treated with suspicion, sometimes with kindness. Small business owners along the route classified the poor people as first class or third class, depending on how many mattresses were on top of the car. Sometimes you couldn't see the car for all the stuff tied on.
I was just a small-time country boy when I left that dusty town. Route 66 to the westward, and I hopped an old freight down. California, here I come, by the side door pullman and the sunburnt thumb. They called us Okies, low-down bums, and the police on us frowned. Never tire of the road, never tire of the rolling wheel, never tire of the ways of the world. Way out yonder's a calling me, and the dark road leads me onwards, and the highway, that's my code. And the lonesome voice that I heard in my head said, never tire of the road.
The long Highway 66, such as between Laguna and, say, Winslow, the people that came through would run out of money for food and for gas.
Lee Marmon, a prominent Indian photographer, grew up in Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico.
People here didn't know anything about the Depression. they were so poor that it didn't make any difference to them. And the local people would always pitch in and give them enough to get to the next town. And then at the next town, they'd do the same, and that's the way they got to California.
By the 1930s, chains of gas stations emerged. It wasn't long before tourist courts, cafes, and dance halls sprang up. In the early days of the railroad, when Fred Harvey ran hotels and Indian detours, the Southwest was an exotic attraction. Dave Edmonds of the University of Texas, Dallas.
Route 66 is the first time an overland trail outside of a railroad opens up many of the Native American communities of the Southwest to non-Indian people. And these non-Indian people who are coming west already have a stereotyped image of what Native American people should be. Other Native American people are entrepreneurs, and they realize that if someone is coming from Ohio and they think Indian people, all Indian people wear headdresses and live in teepees, and they want to buy a rubber tomahawk, they'll sell them a rubber tomahawk.
Despite the dark days of the Depression, the highway continued to grow. Then, as World War II began, the promise of good-paying jobs sent a tide of people flowing down Route 66. This time, it was airplane wings and tank parts, not oranges, luring folks westward. David Montejano is the past director of the Center for Mexican-American Studies at the University of Texas.
By and large, most of the Mexican-Americans who traveled along Route 66 in the 30s and 40s, they were farm workers. In some cases, perhaps small farmers who lost their homesteads, their farms. The reason they're on Route 66 is because they're being pulled by the prospect of some job, perhaps a factory job in Chicago or a factory job in Los Angeles.
Okies and Chicanos weren't the only ones traveling Route 66.
In 1932, many of the Indian people received their allotments, their small pieces of land, but they received them right in the middle of the Great Depression. And they were then asked to pay taxes on them. And as you well know, almost nobody in Oklahoma could pay any taxes on anything in the 1930s. And so many of them were foreclosed upon, and they lost lands. Many Indian people began to migrate west out of Oklahoma into Southern California, and they picked up people as they went.
After the Depression sent Okies west, World War II followed with troops and transports. Gas rationing and tire shortages made it touch and go for many 66 businesses. Planning for interstate highways began soon afterwards.
You're listening to Across the Tracks, a Route 66 story.